Let's turn now to Exodus. Exodus chapter 32. And as well as that, we have taken a reading from Acts chapter 7, where Stephen talks about the incident that we read of in Exodus chapter 32, the making of the golden calf in Horeb. Horeb is just another place for Mount Sinai. And I think as we heard those readings read to us this morning from the scriptures, we felt the solemnity of them, didn't we? And the weightiness of them, and the tragedy of them, and the significance of them, just in the reading. And as we come through this passage, we need to bear in mind what I said a couple of weeks ago, that we read this passage from within places like Psalm 106, which talks about the repeated rebellion and failure of God's people. And when we read passages like Psalm 106, it does not start, "They, O God," but it starts, "We, O God." That the history of God's people that we read of in places such as Exodus chapter 32 is, in one sense, our history. We cannot look at the tragedy that unfolded at the foot of Mount Sinai and say, "We would never have done that." We can't look at the terrible events that took place and say, "That is them and we are different and our righteousness would somehow remain intact and we would never repeat their error." If we read these passages with that mindset, we really lose the heart of the gospel, and we stand on the side of the Pharisee who says, "Thank you, God, I'm not like." So we need to read passages such as Exodus chapter 32 under the ministry of the Spirit to open up our own eyes to the fact that we need to be kept by God, and the propensity of our own heart left to itself by itself is going to be no different than the propensity of the hearts of these people that we read of in Exodus chapter 32. Now, if you need to encapsulate in a couple of sentences what this chapter is about and what this is teaching us, it's simply this: that the God who loves his people, and therefore we could say this, the God who loves you this morning, the God who loves me this morning, is a jealous God. It says, in fact, in Exodus chapter 34, verse 14, that jealous is his name. And the word for jealous, which is often used in relationship to describing Yahweh, describing God, is a word that is related to other Hebrew words for jealousy, but has a particular form that is only ever used of God. And the fact that it has that particular form, I think, teaches us that it has a meaning which is not to be taken in the way that we take the word jealous or jealousy. So we need to talk about what that is and what the difference is. But the first thing to remember is that the God who loves you, the God who loves me, the God who loves these people, is a jealous God. And the second thing is that the fact that he is a jealous God is our only security in life. If he were not a jealous God, we would have no safety. We would have no assurance that we would reach the goal that he's planned for us. If he were not a jealous God and our lives were invaded by something that was wrong and hostile and evil, it would make no difference to him. And so we would just be a prey to them all. So the jealousy of God towards us, the jealousy of God for his holy name, is at the same time our security. And it's therefore not to be heard as a counsel of despair, that is the idolatry of Israel, the continued idolatry of Israel, as a counsel of despair, but a cause of great hope. Because beyond this covenant, which was written with tablets of stone by the finger of God, as has been clearly emphasised in the end of chapter 31 and also into chapter 32, verse 16 and 17. What a remarkable gift this was, these tablets inscribed by the finger of God directly. And finger in Luke's gospel means spirit. If I, by the finger of God, means the Spirit of God, cast out demons. So written by the Spirit on tablets of stone, given direct to Moses, and that covenant has now been superseded by one in which the same Spirit writes that same law on tablets of your own heart. That's the difference between the covenant which they broke and the covenant in which we stand. So there is a covenant beyond the broken covenant, which is our hope. But the covenant beyond the broken covenant and this covenant itself, the one which they broke, have both been enacted by the God who's a jealous God. So that's where we're heading this morning. Firstly then, what does it mean that he is a jealous God? When we hear that word, jealous, and associated verbs, jealousy, for example, associated adverbs and so forth, adjectives, we think usually of a negative emotion. Jealousy for us is connected with envy. You're jealous of something that you cannot have, and you think that if you see someone else having what you cannot have, that your happiness is compromised and that theirs is unfairly given. And you become prey to what Grant called in his poem, the sideways look. How burdensome to mind and heart is the sideways look. So we think of jealousy often as a negative emotion associated with envy. If you think it through a little bit, you'll find also that that negative emotion of jealousy is associated with insecurity. You become jealous of people and things that relate to your deepest levels of insecurity. It touches the very core of your being because you're trying to stabilise yourself as a person. And in order to stabilise yourself, you're turning to certain things to help prop you up, you know. And those things that we turn to, we then have to keep screwing back in place because Dagon-like, they keep toppling over. And we keep having to nail their feet to the ground in order to keep them stable, and that doesn't work because God won't let them stand. But out of that mess of insecurity, we get jealous of those things which seem to secure other people. And because of all of that, therefore, jealousy relates to issues such as covetousness. Covetousness which amounts to idolatry. And covetousness in turn relates to issues such as anger and unfairness and injustice. So when we have the word jealousy, it stands in the middle of a sort of theological field and a semantic field of really quite some significance, doesn't it? But this particular form of the word jealous, who's this God whose name is jealous, it says in Exodus 34, that's not the way God is in his jealousy. When God is jealous for his people, when God is jealous for his holy name, God is exercising his holy love to preserve that which he has revealed and to keep that which he has promised. To preserve that which he has revealed, to keep that which he has promised. So he reveals himself as the Lord Most High, slow to anger, abounding in love and compassion and so forth. He reveals himself as the God who brings his people out of Egypt. He reveals himself as God who acts on their behalf. He reveals himself as God who comes to them when they could not help themselves. He reveals himself as the God of grace, who always takes the initiative to show mercy. He reveals himself as the God who does that in all of his holiness, so that his forgiveness is never just an amnesty on sin, but it's a true and just atonement. He reveals himself as Yahweh, whose name is holy. He reveals himself as the God who is the creator of heaven and earth. He reveals himself as the one who makes covenant with his people. That whole revelation is his name, and he is jealous for his name. His people, will not be allowed to profane his name. He will act to preserve his name, because he alone is the true and faithful witness in the whole universe. And Satan and the world and the flesh, every force against him is bearing false witness about his character and his name. He alone is the true witness, and he will not allow his true name to be polluted by false witness. He is jealous for his name, because that name is who he is. That name is the description of not just who he is, but the mercy and love and kindness and patience and covenant faithfulness that he has. That's all bound up with his name, and that name is the name in which we shelter and hide, and so that name is never going to be allowed to be polluted and compromised. He's jealous for his name. He's jealous for what he's revealed. But he's also jealous for what he's promised. He has promised in that revelation to bring blessing to the nations. He's promised to undo the work of the evil one who tempted Adam and Eve in the garden. You read about it in Exodus chapter 3. And he's made a promise that there would come one from the seed of woman who would crush the serpent's head, and that through that one there would be blessing that would come to God's people and to the nations, to the uttermost parts of the earth. God has promised all of these things for our blessing, and he's promised them for his glory, and God is jealous for those promises, that they will never be compromised, that they will never be taken away. And the end that he has set for us, the end that he set for the whole of the creation, will in fact be reached. His purpose is to bring the blessing of his name to the uttermost parts of the earth. His purpose is to have all of the nations of the earth settled under the revelation of the glory of his grace. His purpose is to bring the blessing of Abraham, which is the gift of the Spirit, to every tribe and tongue and people and nation. His purpose is to have us all settled, even nestled into the bosom of the Father, even as the Son is settled, even nestled into the bosom of the Father. These things he has promised. These things will be accomplished. These things will be accomplished by his own grace. Everything will be to the praise of the glory of his grace in the last day. And he is jealous for us that no one will snatch us from his hand in the fulfillment of those promises. So that's the sort of jealous God you have, whose name will never be compromised, whose promises will never be broken. And that jealous God, therefore, out of that pure jealousy, not envy, not insecurity, not covetousness, that God, out of his pure jealousy, acts to preserve his holy name. He acts to keep that which he's promised. He acts in order to bless his people. He acts so that the idols will not finally destroy us. So this is the God of whom we read in Exodus chapter 32, who comes to preserve his name, to bless his people, and to save them from the destruction that the idolatry would bring. Now we understand that sort of jealousy in some sense. We understand it imperfectly, and we understand it impurely. But any one of us who's had children, as the writer to the Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 12, we discipline our children as seems best to us. And sometimes our children think that we don't do it very well. And sometimes we as parents know that we haven't done it very well. Just talk to our kids sometime about it. But when we discipline our children as seems best to us, we try and discipline, do we not, as parents for their good? And we see that perhaps there's some influence coming into their life, something which is twisting and perverting them, something which is causing them to depart from the things which will bring them blessing. And is your heart as a parent not turned over within you? And would you not go to the ends of the earth if you could to prevent that happening in your children? And isn't the pain that you sometimes feel that these children, right from the very day of their conception and certainly from the day of their birth, are independent little horrors who just make their own choices, don't they? And you just think you're getting them all shaped up and they break out in some other direction rather. But we discipline as best to them, and that is a sort of jealousy for them. Can you understand what I mean? Imperfect though it is. Or we might understand it in the terms of relationship with a husband or a wife, that in that there's a jealousy where we want to guard and protect, we want to enhance the life of the other, we want to adorn the head and the frame, we want that person to be built up in glory, we want that person to be loved and protected and honoured, and we fear that lest there's someone or something might come in and divert that purity and simplicity and joy of devotion. And when that starts to make its way into a relationship, you feel all of the tension and the pain of it very, very deeply, don't you? And so in that sense, we sometimes become jealous in the negative sense. We become angry and bitter and critical and suspicious and hostile and all the things we shouldn't. But at the root of it, something we can understand. There's a sort of covenanted relationship that you want to keep as a covenanted relationship. Now, if we could remove all elements of imperfection and take away all elements of lack of human wisdom, and certainly remove all elements of sinful response, then you can understand something of what the jealousy of God is for his name and for his people. And the jealousy of Christ for his church, who has betrothed himself to his bride, who has bled himself out to death for them, that he would present to them, present us to him, spotless and without wrinkle, blameless on the last day. And in a sense, we who are pastors and shepherds of the flock, in a sense, we are jealous for the flock. We don't want anything to come in that was going to disturb. And that's why sometimes people say, well, why don't you do more exciting stuff? Because you don't want exciting stuff to end up just being people out of control, like happened here in Exodus chapter 32. Can you see all of those things? And so here God acts in the holiness of his own pure jealousy to move out against that which has entered the very camp of his people. Now, it's sometimes been said that it was very easy, relatively speaking, for God to get Israel out of Egypt. The biggest problem was to get Egypt out of Israel, because they could be brought out of the physical presence of the idols. We've been told already in Exodus chapter 12, verse 12, that God rescued them from the gods of Egypt. And Pharaoh was the chief of those gods who opposed himself to God, is the one from whom they had been rescued, and physically they were no longer in Pharaoh's domain. But it becomes very clear as you read the Old Testament accounts, and as you read the words of Stephen in Acts chapter 7, verse 35 and following, that Israel carried with them in their hearts, but also they carried with them physically various forms of idolatry which they had picked up from Egypt. But even if you go back far enough, it's stuff they'd picked up from beyond the river, that is, beyond the Euphrates. This is centuries before the sorts of things that Abraham was released from. Abraham, who was an idol worshipper in Ur of the Chaldees. If you read the Old Testament accounts of Joshua, of Jacob and Isaac and all of those people, you'll find that they've had tucked away in various corners of their houses. And in their person, so to speak, they've carried the idols with them in their hearts. Now that battle persists all the way through the scriptures. And it ends, as Stephen has told us in Acts chapter 7, it ends with Israel first and then Judah being taken off into exile. Now when they came back many years later, they did not have physical idols anymore. But that didn't solve the problem. Because when we meet Israel in the New Testament, it was full of covetousness and full of envy. And the Apostle Paul tells us that greed and covetousness amount to idolatry. So the issue of idolatry is not just the physical form, it's what comes from the heart. As John Calvin said, the heart is an idol factory. it manufactures idols and our hands give shape to them. But even if our hands have not given shape to an idol which we will bow down to, the heart will still be manufacturing things, and that heart will manufacture them out of its own sense of insecurity and fear, and it'll be trying to stabilise all of these various competing idols, nailing them all down as one after another topples over. So Israel had this constant tendency to drift into physical idolatry, but the constant tendency to drift into the physical worship of idols was because of what was emanating from their hearts, what they cherished, what they carried with them. That constant tendency you see in the New Testament as Jesus is moving amongst the people of Israel in New Testament times. What will they put their confidence in is the continual question. Will they put their confidence in the word of Christ, or will they put their confidence somewhere else? And as you travel through the New Testament letters, you find there's these constant warnings against the idolatry of the surrounding nations, but also that idolatry which just comes from within our own hearts. So this battle that we read of Exodus 32 is in some senses our battle. This falling and this stumbling is in some senses our falling and our stumbling. So what in fact took place here? Well, we've had in the chapters preceding this, Exodus 25 to Exodus 31, a magnificent and detailed description of the building of the tabernacle. Now, to paraphrase the writer of the Hebrews, there are many things of which we cannot speak now in detail. If you go through those chapters, 25 to 31, you will find that they have very full descriptions of what the tabernacle looked like inside and how things were to be formed and shaped and where they were to be placed and what they were to be made of and what the colours were like. And as you read it, you get this impression that God is going to great trouble to make a place of beauty for his people to come to. He is, in one sense, like a host preparing his house to receive honoured visitors. In another sense, it is like Eden being all tended and kept and made in its most beautiful array so that his sons and daughters may come into the palace garden which Eden was. It is, in another sense, like everything in order as it was on Sinai, with his presence with them. And God in these chapters is describing how the tabernacle is to be built, and all of the colour and the splendour and the detail and the beauty of it is to say, I am a God who gives in abundance the things that you need. And I, God, invite you to come to my house. And I adorn my house in such a way that as you come into my house, the house speaks to you about who I am, and it speaks to you about my grace, and it tells you of my beauty, and just as you look at it, it fills you with joy, because I, your God, am the one who loves you, and I've created this for you, and you are to come into my presence, and we are to eat and to drink and to have fellowship together. It's a beautiful picture. Another way you could speak about it, perhaps, is as a husband who's gone ahead and he's prepared, you know, the first home for where they will live together, and he's filled all the cracks and he's painted all of the walls and he's just got it beautiful for his bride. And then in Exodus chapter 32, chaos, utter chaos. There's an element of violence in the worship. The translation we heard read for us said, take off the earrings that are in your ears. Literally it means rip out. Rip out the earrings. And there are other passages from Genesis chapter 34, where it may well be that these earrings had some sort of cultic, almost astrological type significance. And the people come, it doesn't come clear to us in the English, but there's some sense of menace as they approach Aaron. It's not just a dispassionate request presented as a memo on a nice email. They gather round Aaron, and the way this phrase is used in just a couple of other places in the Old Testament, they sort of menace him. They have him in the middle. It's as though there's some threat. And the threat is based on the fact that Moses is no longer with them. And as the conversation unfolds, it becomes very clear that they've actually put their faith in Moses. This Moses who brought us up out from Egypt. This Moses. Not Yahweh. Not the Lord. They have attached themselves in some sense to Moses, not the God of Moses. Not their own God. And they come with this sense of menace, this sense of threat. And Aaron says, well, rip out them. Rip them out. He himself is responding in some sense out of violence and anger in this. The people give these gold ornaments to Aaron. We are told very clearly that it's fashioned and it's shaped, so there's thought that's gone into the construction of this thing. But a little later, when Moses speaks to Aaron about it, Aaron says, well, what could I do? They're a stubborn people. You yourself know they're a stubborn people. You know they've been stiff-necked people. You know they've never obeyed. You know how much they've grumbled even from the very first day we came out. So what was I to do? And besides, I threw the gold into the fire and out came this calf. Yeah, right. But let's not be too harsh in our criticism of Aaron. He had let the people get out of control. But there is a deceitfulness of sin and a deceitfulness of idolatry which always presents itself in some way as miraculous. Behind the idols stands a malevolent power of Satan himself. This is not an alternative religious festival. This is something which is driven by the very central controlling power of hell itself. Satan stands as the controlling force behind all idolatry, whatever form it takes. And one of the things that you'll always notice about idolatry, in whatever form it takes, it tries to present itself in some way as being able to do magical things. And perhaps the deceit and blindness had got so much into Aaron's mind, it was not just a lame excuse, but by that point he'd actually started to begin to believe that it was a miraculous event, that this golden calf should come forth from the fire. But the people themselves, as they came to worship this object, understood that they were worshipping someone or something that was common in the ancient world. Now, if we had time this morning, we could go through many parts of the ancient world, and you'll find the bull cult was there all the way through, not least in Egypt. But here there's a new element. If you'd have a look at Exodus chapter 32, verse 3, the people tore off the gold rings which are in their ears, brought them to Aaron. He took this from their hand, he fashioned it with a graving tool, made it into a molten calf. This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to Yahweh. In other words, he's making an identification between this God and Yahweh. And then in verse 6, the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And those two phrases, burnt offerings and peace offerings, are phrases used to describe legitimate offerings to Yahweh in the worship in the tabernacle. So these people are saying, we can worship God on our own terms, and we can actually, in doing what we're doing, give honour and glory to Yahweh, but in the way that we want to bring honour and glory to Yahweh. That, beloved, is what's called syncretism. It is a bringing together of things which do not belong and cannot mix. Most of what we read in the New Age movement and all those sort of things today is syncretistic. And much of what happens in Christian spirituality, so-called in that branch, so to speak, of spirituality, is syncretistic. It's trying to blend things which don't mix. It's bringing together elements of astrology and idolatry and Buddhism and superstition in other religions and all sorts of practices that don't fit with the gospel, and saying you can just blend them all together and you can construct a worship that's pleasing to yourself. And in all of that worship, because it all leads to the same place, God will be pleased. And God won't be pleased. Because behind anything that is not given from above stands that which comes up from below. And the menace that stands at the heart of the camp here is the menace of evil, which would utterly and completely destroy God's people if it got hold of them. And Yahweh, who is a jealous God, jealous for his holy name, jealous for the promises he's made to his people, will not let them be destroyed. Now, our time's running away, but we'll make just two or three points as we come towards the end. The first is this. God knew what he was going to do. He's not taken by surprise. But he actually tests out Moses in this. And he says, in effect, Moses, you stand aside. I'm not going to renege on my promises. I'll just get them fulfilled through you rather than them. It's a bit of a test, isn't it? And what's Moses' response? No, Lord, you blot me out of the book before you blot them. So what a revelation that is to Moses of what God's done in Moses. Like when God came to Abraham and said, take your son, your only son. And Abraham says, here I am, Lord. What a revelation to Abraham of what God's done to Abraham. And Moses stands as the intercessor before God, as God knew he would. But when Moses intercedes for the people, he doesn't offer any excuse, because, as one of the commentators said, their actions were indefensible. Their excuse was, Moses has delayed coming down. And interestingly enough, go into a little diversion for a second. In 2 Peter, it talks about those days coming at the last days where people will say, where is the promise of his coming? He has been so long and the world goes on just as it always has. And that becomes the excuse for all sorts of things that are ungodly and unrighteous. The delay in the coming of Moses becomes the excuse. It's not a reason. It's just an excuse. There's a difference between an excuse and a reason, isn't there? This is the excuse. But as they come in all of that anger and rebellion, Moses, who has delayed coming because he's in the presence of God, who's bringing to Moses the most glorious gift of worship, this Moses is now their intercessor. Their actions are indefensible, so he doesn't try to offer any excuse for them. The only thing that Moses pleads is, God, you are God. You've said things, you've revealed things, you've promised things, you've said that you're going to bring your blessing through these people. So God, you do what you've said. And that is the sort of intercession that God likes. The sort of intercession that God doesn't like is, oh, well, I was tired and I was overwrought and we just, you know, all of that's excuse. Our sin and our idolatry before God is utterly indefensible. And the only place we have to flee is God. And the only place we have to stand are the promises of God. And the only mercy we find are the mercies of God. So Moses doesn't offer any excuse for the people All he says is, God, this is who you are, this is what you've promised, this is what you've said, and I'm going to take my stand here, and I believe that you will still have mercy on your people. So Moses has learnt something, hasn't he, over the years? Now, the necessity of judgment must be worked out. It must happen. It cannot have a great number of people indulged in blatant idolatry, syncretizing that worship in the camp of Israel. He cannot have that and just let it stand. So the judgment comes. It comes through the Levites, and it comes also through the judgment of God himself directly. But the mercy is that he prunes rather than destroys. He does not obliterate the people, even though from one sense all the people were there. He cuts off those branches in him which bears no fruit, so to speak. And the pruning of the vine which takes place in the judgment is for the preservation of the holy name. But all of this leads us to the greatest thing that we need to share today in the last minute or two, and it's this: that beyond this broken covenant, there is another covenant. This covenant, which they broke so demonstrably here, was broken again and again and again and repeatedly in the life of Israel for centuries. And God himself says, I will come to you. I will gather you. I will cleanse your heart from all of its idolatry. I will sprinkle clean water on you. I will wash you and you will be clean. I will write my law on your heart. I will be your God and you will be my people. And I'm going to do all of this for the sake of my holy name, which you've profaned, so that you and the nations all together would know that I have done it. And that covenant, beloved, has been enacted. It's been secured by someone greater than Moses, who is your intercessor. He has been your intercessor on the cross. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. He has been your intercessor in the bearing of your sins in his body on the tree. There was no one to intervene, so God intervened. He himself bore the sins in his body on the tree. In the body of the Son of God, God intervened against your idolatry. And he continues now as your intercessor in heaven, praying for you at God's right hand. Not because God is against you, but because all of the enemies are against you and God is for you. He is an advocate because God is for you, not against you. And that intercession, beloved, and the jealousy of God's holy name revealed in that cross, the jealousy for his own promises given to us in the new covenant through the blood of his Son, that jealousy is the holy, holy grace by which you're secured. And so you stand today not because you would not do what Israel did in Exodus 32. You stand today because Christ has done even more than Moses could ever do in Exodus 32. And that, beloved, is the joy of the worship in which we share, is it not? Your life is secured by Christ in God.